recently, as I'm sure you know, Canada had a federal election and the Liberal Party won. And it became a popularly circulated message among youth and left-leaning communities to vote strategically in order to prevent Harper from getting reelected. And another driving principle behind strategic voting was the notion of making your vote count instead of voting for a party that had little to no chance of getting elected already. And so what do you think the positive and negative effects of strategic voting are? And how do you think it impacts society's conception of democracy?
Well, I think too much emphasis is placed on voting. And the Canadian political system is very different from the American political system in that you're not as hostage to corporate money. I mean, our elections, which are interminable, I think yours lasted 40 days or something, are going to cost over $7 billion. And our two major parties are completely beholden to corporate power. But I think that people who focus too much on elections forget that actual social change is caused by movements. And those movements pressure those within the power elite to respond. You saw that with the Quebec student movement, for instance. I also think that there's not going to be as much difference under Trudeau as most people expect. Trudeau, like Obama, has no real political record. Yes, he sat in Parliament, but he didn't do much. And I think a lot of people are reading whatever they want into him. I don't see any evidence that the Liberals are going to revoke C-51, which in many ways is worse than the American Patriot Act. I don't see any evidence that they're going to significantly halt the exploitation of the tar sands. And I think that Canadians should remember that it was the Liberal Party that pushed through austerity. So I think he's very much an Obama-like figure in that, you know, he brings in a certain diversity and he speaks in a very different rhetoric. But will the structure actually change in a significant way? I doubt it. And I think that all of our energy has to be put into building movements, and, you know, whether that's anti-fracking, whether that's in the United States raising the minimum wage or Black Lives Matter. I mean, we just have an epidemic of gun violence here, much of it carried out by the police. So, go ahead and vote. But I think too often people place too much faith in elected figures, especially ones that, you know, appear as Obama did or as Trudeau does to offer something fresh and new. And we don't have time for that anymore. The climate is unraveling at a frightening pace alone. The security and surveillance apparatus makes us the most watched, monitored, eavesdropped, photographed population in human history. And I covered the Stasi state in East Germany. And in moments of instability or unrest, the state, any state, including the Canadian state, will use these mechanisms of control, including militarized police, which has taken place in Canada, as we saw during the G20 protests in Toronto. So I think we're up against something, you know, very, very frightening and very, very serious, and that is the rise of a kind of global neo-feudalism that has harnessed forms of control unseen in human history. And that as it continues to exploit both the ecosystem for profit and labor, and we haven't even spoken about the Transatlantic Pacific, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which Trudeau has not rejected, and which really trumps, you know, environmental laws, labor rights, and hands that power to these secret corporate tribunals. I mean, this is what's the kind of farce that's happening in Paris, where you have these non-binding agreements. But if you look at the TPP, can override any non-binding agreement, especially in terms of environmental protection. So, yeah, I vote, but I vote within the American elections, you know, to register my distaste for the entire system. And while the system's better in Canada, and we also should add that, by the way, the TPP may destroy your universal health care system, although Harper went a long way to degrading it. I mean, we have to look at these forces because this is where power actually lies.
As you yourself expressed slightly, and also in the media and other activists have been vocalizing this disillusionment with American and also Canadian politics and in general government perpetuated social problems. It indicates that society is on the brink of revolution, and this is a big topic in your book, Wages of Rebellion. However, many activists have already been publishing their views on social media, Twitter, going in the streets, marching, protesting. And so what do you imagine a full-on revolution will look like, and what does it require?
Well, I spend a lot of time in the book looking at the precursors of revolution throughout history. You know, what are the indicators that seismic change of that nature is possible? And the indicators are all there. The discrediting of the ruling ideology, neoliberalism, which, as Marx understood, is really the expression of the dominant economic and political elites. I mean, it justifies their excesses, their greed, has been discredited across the political spectrum. People are not buying the myth that the unfettered market, which funnels money upwards into the hands of a tiny oligarchic elite, is good for working men and women or good for the middle class. It doesn't promote democracy. In fact, we have seen an evisceration of our most cherished civil liberties, including our right to privacy, as true in Canada as it is in the United States, as in Europe. And so we're in this period that the anarchist Alexander Berkman, in an essay called Invisible Revolution, is kind of uncoupling from a belief in the ruling ideology and searching for both a language and a vision to replace it. And Berkman in that essay said that at moments like this, the actual movement, the revolutionary tide, is subterranean and largely invisible, as those ideas that buttressed power are more and more rendered hollow and powerless, and that you don't, when things erupt, it's like water coming to a boil in a kettle. You don't see it boiling, and suddenly you see the steam and hear the whistle. That's kind of where we are. We're already seeing some pretty seismic shifts in the American political landscape with the rise of these proto-fascist Republican candidates, and in particular Donald Trump, who may very well capture the nomination for the Republican Party. And he is channeling, I would argue, a legitimate rage on the part of white, the disenfranchised white working poor, working men and women, who have turned against a liberal elite embodied in figures like Obama and the Clintons, who speak in that traditional feel your pain language of liberalism, and yet have sold working men and women out. And what's been, so pernicious, and we just had Trump announced that, he would attempt to ban all Muslims entering the United States. What's pernicious is that that liberal elite justified itself through cultural diversity. So it, but it upended the notion of, traditional concepts like feminism. So feminism was no longer about empowering and promoting oppressed women. It was about having female CEOs or a woman president. Cultural diversity became not about lifting up African Americans in our internal colonies who live in situations of poverty and violence and infrastructure collapse, which dwarfs anything we've seen for decades. But it becomes about electing a black president who, as Cornel West says correctly, serves as a black mascot for Wall Street. And so you have this disenfranchised white underclass that is turning against a liberal establishment and turning against what it sees as the promotion of minorities and oppressed within the society at their expense. Now, in fact, the liberals have not promoted the oppressed. The assault against African Americans in this country, especially in terms of the explosion of mass incarceration, was really given to us by Bill Clinton, who also destroyed our welfare system. And it used to be that under our old welfare system, 70% of the recipients were children. But because of the mendacity of their rhetoric, what we're seeing is a very frightening backlash against not only self-identified liberal politicians, but supposedly liberal values. Now, that's something that I watched, by the way, in the breakdown of Yugoslavia. And that was also true in the breakdown of Weimar. And it gives rise to these proto-fascist movements that target their rage towards the vulnerable: Muslims, undocumented workers, homosexuals, intellectuals, feminists, liberals. And that's what we're seeing in the United States. And the Republican establishment is kind of horrified, but it's the Frankenstein that they created because they played these culture wars like the Democrats, while both of the parties empowered corporations to establish what the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls a system of inverted totalitarianism. And by that, it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. So you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, a free press, civil liberties, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet internally have seized all of the levers of power to render the citizen impotent. And, you know, anytime a tiny cabal, in this case a corporate cabal, seizes power and directs the mechanisms of government towards its own empowerment and enrichment at the expense of the citizenry, you induce what's happened, which is political paralysis, the inability of the state to respond to the most basic concerns and rights of the citizenry. And of course, in many ways, ignores what the citizenry wants, because the citizenry has been rendered, in essence, powerless. So in 2008, constituent calls across the political spectrum to the Congress were against the bailouts, 100-1 against the bailouts, yet they pass anyway. Nobody wants their privacy taken from them. You know, this goes on and on and on. And what you get is a legal system that reinterprets traditional rights and overturns them by judicial fiat. So suddenly, unlimited corporate cash infused into elections to control them becomes the right to petition the government, or a form of free speech. And that's where we are. Now, our backlash, especially in the United States, which, unlike Canada, is within its DNA a very, very violent culture, may manifest itself as a right-wing backlash, and we're already seeing it. And so, you know, the upheavals that beset us may not be salutary or good. They may, in fact, be frightening.
So working as a foreign correspondent, as you did for many years, you were witness to countless human rights violations and corruptions that many populations in the Western world are totally blind to, both literally as they are out of sight and mentally as the dialogue's not popular or they're not informed or consumed by these issues. And how do you think this visual representation affects your perspective as a journalist and a social justice writer?
Well, it's obviously a lot on many levels. One, I've covered disintegrating societies, so it's not academic for me. I know what the signs are. I know how they collapse. I've covered, you know, the revolutions in Eastern Europe. I was in the Magic Lantern Theater every night in Prague with Václav Havel. I covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years. Both of the Palestinian intifadas or uprisings, the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic. So I'm aware of how seismic change manifests itself, what state repression looks like. I think being in disintegrating societies gives me an awareness of the potential for human evil, what human beings are capable of and how frightening that can be. But most importantly, it gives me an understanding of empire, how empire works. Because the image of empire, at the heart of empire, is completely fictitious. The idea that we're going into the Middle East to protect the liberty of women in Afghanistan or promote democracy. This is absolutely ludicrous once you start using the explosive devices. You can't use the word human rights at that point. And the brutality of empire really exposes the soul of empire, in particular the soul of the United States. And as the country deteriorates, what happens, and this always happens with imperial powers, is that the harsher forms of control on the outer reaches of empire that are unseen, as you correctly point out, and even not known by the residents of empire, migrate back to the heart of empire. And that's what we're already seeing in terms of militarized police. We have 3.1 people in America, most of them unarmed, most of them poor people of color, are killed every single day by law enforcement in this country. We have the same kind of evisceration of civil liberties that are used to subjugate those Iraqis, Afghanis, other people on the outer reaches of empire, the return of militarized drones. Empires, in essence, hollow themselves out from the inside. And then as they disintegrate, the empire uses these vicious forms of control and violence that are very common to those who are oppressed by empire beyond its borders to oppress those at home. And that's what's happening.
Your most recent column on Truthdig, titled Apocalyptic Capitalism, discusses the impact that the Paris Climate Summit will have and the social effects of environmental degradation in general. You say, quote, "We have to let go of our relentless positivism, our absurd mania for hope, and face the bleakness of reality before us." So what do you think the role of despair in revolution and social justice is?
I don't think despair is particularly useful, but realism is essential. As long, and that's what I mean by this kind of positivism and mania for hope, this kind of Candide-like belief that things are just going to get better and better. They're not. I mean, even if we stop all carbon emissions today, we are still going to suffer catastrophic effects of climate change. And of course, we're not stopping it. I mean, the first climate summit was 1988, and carbon emissions have risen by 60%. And these people aren't, who are tied into the elites or the people who gave us the TPP, have no intention of doing anything other than cosmetic reforms, which will have no enforceable qualities to them. That is, as I write in Wages of Rebellion, the kind of great existential crisis of our time, to at once accept the bleakness of the reality around us and resist anyway. We can't use the word hope if we don't resist. But it doesn't help us to build a better society if we don't understand the configurations of power. If we think the Trudeau government is going to deal with this in any substantial way, then we don't understand corporate power. And so, no, despair, like cynicism, are deadly forces. And yet, the thing is, it's not good out there. It's not good in terms of the way we're shackled by this security and surveillance apparatus, the way that corporate power is unassailable, the reconfiguration of the global economy into a neo-feudalism, which the TPP will push through on steroids. All of that's real. And that comes from covering wars, where you could not afford to be Pollyannish. You had to make a very cold calculation about what the weapon systems were at the end of that road, what their capacity to hurt you or kill you were, and then proceed. People had kind of very Pollyannish views or believed they were immortal, and I saw them are often dead in wars. So I think that cold reading of our reality is is key, because it tells us that our responses have to be sustained acts of mass civil disobedience, breaking the back in big and small ways, of the corporate culture or the consumer society, including not eating animal products. The animal agriculture industry is one, many people argue, the greatest contributor to climate change. And the ag-gag laws, the ability of this industry to essentially silence all debate about it is quite frightening. And we have to prepare for what's coming instead of pretending that it's not coming. Because the disruptions, especially in the global south, which are already beginning, will lead to, you know, mass migrations, failed states, the flooding of coastal cities. This is what the future will bring. We can have happy thoughts and pretend it won't, or pretend that, you know, somehow it'll be, we can adapt or we can fix, but this is to live in self-delusion.
Your expression for distaste for commercial and popular media are well known, yet you're a journalist yourself. And how do you see journalism as a radical act?
Well, it's a radical act when it tells the truth, or attempts to tell the truth insofar as we can determine it. News and truth are not the same thing. As journalists, and I worked for the New York Times for 15 years, we manipulate facts. That's what we do for a living. If you care about the truth, you will manipulate those facts in such a way as to express the truth. But journalists who care more about the truth than they do about the news or about their own careers eventually have problems in the institutions that they work in. The best journalism has always been carried out on the fringes of the journalistic establishment. You know, Ida B. Wells, the great crusader against lynching, who exposed it, had her newspaper office burned down by mobs in Memphis, had to flee the city. I.F. Stone, probably arguably America's greatest investigative journalist of the 20th century, became a pariah. He couldn't get a job even at The Nation magazine and started I.F. Stone's Weekly in his basement. This has always been the case. So, you know, I write for a website called Truthdig, run by Robert Scheer, who used to be the editor of Ramparts in the 1960s. Well, Ramparts, you know, never made a dime. They were always broke, but they were the ones who exposed COINTELPRO. They first published Eldridge Cleaver in this series that became Soul on Ice. They published the iconic photograph of the small girl, the Vietnamese girl, running down the road naked, being burned by napalm, and they shame the traditional press into doing their job. That's always been the role of the alternative press, which is not beholden to commercial interests or corporate power, advertising dollars, ratings, or whatever. But real journalists have always struggled on the margins of the journalistic community itself. And we saw that with Occupy. The first week in Zuccotti, you had three women kettled, they were pepper sprayed by the police. Those images were all caught by independent journalists embedded within the Zuccotti itself. None of the mainstream media was there. And yet those images had a kind of seismic effect throughout the country. I'm a great believer in journalism. It's becoming harder and harder to do. It's extremely difficult to make a living at it anymore, but it's vital, and you see this with WikiLeaks or with Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange, because when you have wholesale surveillance, it shuts down the possibility of investigative journalism into the centers of power, because they can always trace back who delivered the leaks. And Obama's assault on civil liberties, in particular on the freedom of the press, has been worse than Bush. And that's why Snowden fled the country. So the state goes after the last people who can pull back the veil and show us what power is doing, and that's the hackers. People like Jeremy Hammond, people like Julian Assange, people like Chelsea Manning, people like Edward Snowden. Because I have colleagues at the New York Times who still do investigative journalism, will tell you that nobody in the government will talk to them about criminal activity or malfeasance or fraud carried out by the government. The death of journalism, which is characteristic of any totalitarian state, and its replacement with spectacle, and emotionally driven images and stories. The destruction of journalistic enterprises that are not dependent on corporate money, like the public broadcasting system in the United States, which has at this point been completely destroyed, the assaults that Harper carried out against the CBC, the assaults against the BBC, these are all attempts to make sure that the message that corporate power delivers across the media landscape is utterly uniform. And we already see it in the United States where, for instance, on Syria, the debate is about, I'm talking about the mainstream media, the debate becomes, well, should we bomb them or should we bomb them and put boots on the ground, as if those are the only two alternatives to the crisis in Iraq and Syria. It's what Freud called the narcissism of minor difference. But that's where we're at. And I'm watching, I watch these pundits on television wax long about the Middle East, where they've never been. I mean, I spent 7 years there. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I speak Arabic. But my narrative and understanding of what it is that has created ISIS and what we have done throughout the region so contradicts the dominant narrative that despite the fact that I have far more expertise in the Middle East than any of these people being called upon to talk about the crisis, you're shut out. You're not going to be given a voice. And that's new, because if you go back a couple decades, you could hear figures like Noam Chomsky or Ralph Nader or Susan Sontag or others, at least on public broadcasting. You won't hear those voices anymore.